This is the Ohm Journal Mix podcast. I am Maria Nattestad, and
I'm Robert Abuccalio. Today is the final episode of the season, and we are talking about career capital, as we promised you in episode one. So here we are.
Yep, we are exploring Cal Newport's ideas in his book, So Good They Can't Ignore You, and how those apply to bioinformatics and to our own experiences in our careers. So the central message of So Good They Can't Ignore You, which I have right here, is that working right trumps finding the right work. So, for example, he spends much of the beginning of the book beating down the passion hypothesis, which claims that the key to occupational happiness is to first figure out what you're passionate about and then find a job that matches this passion. So my reaction to that, being in bioinformatics, is like, oh, I didn't even know my field existed when I was a kid, or even when I was in high school. I mean, that's ridiculous. If you had asked me when I was in even the beginning stages of a college in biology what genomics is, I wouldn't have been able to tell you. Would I have been able to pinpoint that as my passion? Absolutely not. That would be crazy. And genomics is a whole field. If you had asked me if I was passionate about structural variant analysis and custom data visualization for genomics, I would have said, what do those words mean? Structural variants? What are those? And yet that's like what I did my whole PhD on. So you can't like find a passion and figure it out ahead of time and then run off and study it. That's not gonna, like, that just doesn't really work for scientists.
Yeah, and he talks about a great example of this, of people like Steve Jobs when he gave his famous commencement speech at Stanford. He talked about how people should follow their passion, find something you're passionate about and follow it. What's really interesting is that in the book, he tells us that that's not at all what Steve Jobs did. He wasn't passionate about computers or starting a business. He was interested in history and dance and other fields. He just saw this as a little side project so he can make a little bit of money. It's only after the fact that he became passionate about it.
Yeah, it's kind of a tautology to say that you should be passionate about what you do. And I think Cal Newport makes this point very well, that you get passionate once you're really good at something and you understand it deeply. So today I would say that I'm passionate about genomics, structural variant analysis, maybe. But definitely like visualization for genomics, I'm super passionate about that. But yeah, if you're expected to figure that stuff out from the beginning and then follow it, yeah, Steve Jobs didn't do that. He shouldn't have been telling the rest of us to do that either. That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, and I remember that speech when I was younger. I've listened to it at least a couple times, and it sounded like very good advice.
I mean, that type of advice is like the source of some of the like existential crises I've had, where I'm like, but am I really passionate about this? But I'm not passionate about anything. So what am I supposed to do with my life? Like, it's like very troubling. And I think, you know, if I had read this book earlier, I probably would have been able to calm down about that a little bit. And, you know, I don't think I was really passionate about something, but I was pretty good at pretending to care about a class I was taking enough that I would get good at it and I would get an A in the class and stuff. Like I got through a French cinema class in college this way.
How did Just, you do that?
Yeah, like it's not like I was interested in it from the beginning. My friends were not interested in it. A bunch of us were taking it together, like five of us, and I basically just told myself, okay, I'm never gonna get through this unless I try to care about French cinema. I was able to fake it till I made it, you know.
So that's one approach to finding passion, then fake it till you make it. But how do you stumble onto the thing you end up being passionate about? It's almost like, in Steve Jobs' case, it was an accident, probably. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I was never going to become passionate about French cinema, right? I could only do that long enough to like to get by in that class. So I think the key is that there are some things that are within a range of fields that you could be interested in, a range of topics that you care about, or that you could care about if you go deep enough. I don't think French cinema is within the range that I could actually go deep on and really care. It was enough that I could fake it for a semester, and I got interested enough that it wasn't complete torture. And I like became interested.
You know, I think I'm passionate about building tools for scientists to make their lives easier, building tools that people find useful. I don't think I could have also, like you said, predicted that I would be doing this 10 years ago. It's mostly through small steps forward in vaguely the right direction that I discovered this, and I started optimizing for it at every next career decision.
Yeah, so how did you get into making software to make scientists' lives easier?
Well, so it started in grad school. It wasn't supposed to be a big thing. It was supposed to be a side thing, as things are. But that side thing of building a nice UI interface around some algorithms for single cell analysis pretty much became my biggest contribution during grad school. Like, yes, I developed some other algorithms, but in terms of impact, that was by far the main one. It helped users who did not have the wherewithal to figure out the command line and figure out where to run their analyses. It gave them a way to do it, and unblocking them to get to the scientific question they were trying to answer. I think that really resonated a lot. And so when I left grad school, I started looking for biotechs that would let me do the same thing.
I think one interesting thing about that is that what you were supposed to be studying was not making software for scientists.
No, it was not.
What was it?
Well, I was supposed to be building new algorithms for analyzing the single cell data, you know, retracing tumor evolution from copy number events at single cell level. And I did that as well. But that ended up being the least important part.
Right. I think what also points to something interesting, which is that we gradually shape what it is we are going deep on. We don't just like pick a topic and then go deep on that. Like, I was also supposed to be working on long read sequencing in cancer. Like, that was the data set I had. I had PacBio sequencing of a breast cancer cell line, and I was supposed to analyze that somehow. We knew we probably wanted to call like structural variants because there were tons of them in this really messed up cancer genome with tons of rearrangements. We wanted to study that. But I ended up turning that into a visualization thing. Like, I ended up building visualization tools from scratch and teaching myself D3, which is a JavaScript library for custom visualization. And like, that's the skill that ended up being my main career capital that I then used to get every subsequent job and opportunity I've had.
So you mentioned career capital. Please explain yourself.
Right. Okay. Let's see if we can look up what career capital is. Career capital. a description of the skills you have that are rare and valuable to the working world. This is the key currency for creating work you love. Yeah, I would define it as basically, yeah, skills. But they have to be rare and valuable skills. And that is actually kind of a big difference, right? Because you can accumulate lots of skills that are not super rare or valuable.
Right, or rare, but not valuable.
Right.
And so that's interesting. So you said it first started out as building visualizations in D3. Why did you build those out in the first place?
Yeah. Because the data I was working with was complicated and I really wanted to see it. And there wasn't a good way to visualize it using existing tools. IGV just wasn't going far enough and showing enough loci and showing which reads connected across the loci. And it was just like really hard to see rearrangement type variants that cut across the whole genome with the existing tools. So I ended up having to make all of this myself. But I think in your question too, like I personally needed to see it. Lots of other people I know don't have the same like drive to see their data. They might actually be totally happy to look at a VCF file with a list of all the variants and be like, oh, cool, this one goes from this chromosome to this chromosome. Whereas I'm like, no, this isn't good enough. I'm going to need a plot here. Like,
interesting. So it's out of necessity, but it's also a function of your personality, essentially, or how you see things.
Yeah, exactly. One of the things that Cal Newport talked about in the book, you know, combating the passion hypothesis, he talks about how there's all these books and all these quizzes and stuff, like the one like, what color is your parachute? And all of these like personality quizzes that you might have even been given by some teacher or career counselor or something, like college counselor in school, where you're supposed to fill out a bunch of things about your personality, and then it tells you what career would be great for you. I always think it's really funny. The one I got was that I should be a librarian. And now I know exactly why it said that. I am organized. I am systematic. And that was true of me even in high school, right? The thing is, if you're organized, if you like systems, if you like optimizing and creating and following systems, that's also engineering, science, math. It's actually like most STEM fields require this, and librarian is just like a really limited way of looking at what careers you can have with those skills. So like, I'm sure it would tell me that some of the worst careers for me would be preschool teacher or, you know, all of these where it's right. Oh my God. Or anything with sports. But I could have told you that too.
Right. I mean, if that's a question at the end of the day, are these quizzes telling you, first of all, nonsense, but also what you already know? Wouldn't it be more helpful to have a set of questions that we ask ourselves to figure out what are the main themes in what we like to do?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I think Cal Newport definitely agrees with us that these personality quizzes and books and stuff about like using personality tests to directly decide what your career should be or what job you should go out and apply for, that's clearly pointless. And like Cal Newport in the book definitely disagrees with the usefulness of these books and personality tests, but he dismisses it, I think, completely, whereas I would only dismiss some of it. I would say that it's still directionally useful. Some things, I think, don't fit our personalities, and I would never be able to work hard enough at them to get good at it to the point where I can actually become passionate about it too.
It's a really good point. It is important that we listen to ourselves. I mean, I remember when I was a kid, we were asked to make a piece of art. And I remember just drawing a robot on a computer made out of squares and triangles and rectangles, to which the teacher was like, "What are you doing? Art?" And I'm like, "I know, but this is how my brain thinks of art. So this is the best you're gonna get."
Yeah, I love doing like geometric patterns on graph paper.
Yeah.
And I liked some of the techniques of drawing. Like, they had taught us when I was like fairly little, like 10 or less, like 10 years old or younger, they had taught us to use a pencil to trace over a leaf. Like, you put a leaf under the piece of paper and you like trace over it and you can see the lines in it and stuff. I loved that. Next class, they told us to draw a tree. So I traced a leaf again and was like, "Here's a drawing of a tree." Here you go. It's like, I'm
going to need a bigger paper for the rest of the tree.
Right, let me just put the paper up on the bark and go like this. It's like, it is technically correct. The best kind of correct. Yeah, so like, I think our personalities inform what we can actually work hard enough at to get good at it. So I wouldn't completely say, oh, it doesn't matter what career you're in at all, depending on your personality. Just work hard at it and it'll be fine. And you will get passionate. I don't think it's that far. Yeah, no, I don't. That's like the one thing I could find in this entire book that I actually disagree with Cal Newport on. You know, he also goes, he talks about deliberate practice in So Good They Can't Ignore You, which is the book we're discussing today, for those who have lost track.
For those who just joined us.
Right. Or because we haven't said the book's title that many times in the episodes, they might have actually lost track of it. But yeah, and So Good They Can't Ignore, he talks about deliberate practice. He talks even more about this in his next book, Deep Work, which has a lot of advice for really putting into practice, like, how do you get so good they can't ignore you?
So let's talk about that. How do you get so good?
It's about working deeply. So it's all about the deep work. And this is for those of us who are knowledge workers, right? But you could actually draw parallels to anything else, like learning a musical instrument. In fact, he gives a great example in this book about a real guitarist versus himself who played guitar. And he used to just like keep playing the songs that he was already good at, songs he had already learned. And so he might have spent just as many hours as somebody who like became a real guitarist and made it his profession. But the professional guitarist used those hours practicing on just the edge of like discomfort, doing the thing he couldn't quite do yet. So he would play something that's supposed to be really fast, and he would start by playing it kind of slowly because he couldn't play it faster yet without messing up. And so he would like keep speeding it up more and more and more until he could finally get it to where he wants it. And this is because it was a really difficult piece where he had to move his fingers very, very fast. And he keeps like tripping over his fingers. This is my understanding of guitar. It's not great, but I'm basically just regurgitating what's in this book again. We can do the same thing as knowledge workers. I might know how to make a particular kind of plot in Python, but if I need to make a different type of plot, I'll be like, oh, I don't know how to do that in Python yet. Let me go open up R and do it instead, because the last time I made a heat map, it was in R or something. And so if I'm actually being like, okay, hold on, let me actually make sure I learn some new skills here too. Let me stick with Python. Let me figure out what the right way to make a heat map in Python is, so that I'm not like you know, it's about like challenging yourself at least a little bit. That's a super minor example, but yeah, much better examples would be reading papers in your field that you don't understand and that feel really beyond you, and then just going deep until you truly understand that paper, and by extension then you'll hopefully understand some of the field that that paper is situated in. They made us do this for quals. Do you remember this? So both of us went to grad school at Cold Spring Harbor Labs, and for our qualifying exam, the task was we were given a set of 5 papers that center around a topic. Mine was functional regulation, like gene regulation, but I think it was a subfield of that that was like super enhancers, basically, and some of the region, some like 1 or 2 papers were on super enhancers. A couple others were on hot regions, they were called, which might have been inside of the super enhancers. Like if you start to, you know, they didn't cite each other's concepts, but they were, you kind of, if you read deep enough, you're like, is this actually partly the same thing? Is the super enhancer a real thing, or is it just a lot of enhancers really close to each other? Or is it just an especially enhancery enhancer? So like, you can hear it now, even years later, I am actually still kind of passionate about that topic because I spent a whole month and read over 50 papers in that subfield and tried to pick apart these papers on super enhancers to try to figure out if I actually thought the super enhancers were real. And I think they should make all of us do this, but for our actual thesis topics, not for some random other topic.
That was a slight flaw in the system. So going back to deep work, to me, it's having contiguous blocks of time where you're focused on one thing deeply. And I think like a lot of, in the current ways that people work, people really struggle to find time to do deep work because of tools like Slack. Well, it's not necessarily because of Slack. It's because of how we're encouraged implicitly to use Slack, where people will get a notification, immediately reply, instead of seeing it as, this is a asynchronous mode of communication. I will see it when I see it.
I think there's a lot of pressure to be on all the time. And,
but I find that a lot of that pressure is, at least for me, it used to be self-imposed. Where I'm like, I have to be on. If I don't respond, what will they think? Nothing. They will think nothing. Just don't enable notifications on Slack or emails. Unless you're on call or something like that, you do not need to respond within a minute of receiving a message, or even a few hours. It's okay. And that's hard to do.
One thing I looked up for this episode is, like, I was thinking about how in high school biology, you can't pick a PhD topic from your high school biology class. So an example of this is, you might have learned about mitosis. Do you have any idea how many papers there are on mitosis? I looked it up on Google Scholar. There's 800,000 results. 800,000 results on Google Scholar for mitosis.
I'm pretty sure we only spent, I don't know, half an hour talking about this.
We didn't learn about genomics. We didn't learn about DNA sequencing or anything like this. But the things we did learn about, even if you only spent like one class on it, is like an entire ginormous field that lots of people had devoted their entire careers to studying long before it shows up in your high school biology class. So between high school and even just grad school, there's like a huge gap there where you have to fill in a lot of knowledge. Like, you can't find your passion until you get to the edge of your field. And he also talks in the book about the adjacent possible, which is about how even a field has kind of a new frontier that sometimes appears because something else makes something possible. A new type of instrument makes it possible for multiple labs to discover oxygen at the same time the following year. And so, like, you get these waves of innovation that lead to new waves of innovation. And so the adjacent possible is like constantly being pushed out. But you can't find a good research topic until you get to the edge of your field, and it takes so long to get there. So if you are constantly jumping around going, oh, I don't know if I'm interested in this, I'm going to jump to this other field and this other field, you're never getting far enough to where you can actually make an impact, have an important mission for your work.
Well, on that note, I think we have exhaustively covered the topic.
Yeah.
So good.
You guys should totally read the book, though. So good they can't ignore you.
All right. Well, this concludes this episode 7. Thank you so much for listening.
Yeah, and please subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. And you can come over to YouTube to leave comments on this episode. So yeah, thank you so much for listening.